Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Betsy Fentress.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And we're happy to have Sean Pott with us of the Knights of Columbus to talk a very exciting program for men called CORE, which, as many of our listeners might know, is Latin for heart. And it's really trying to form and guide young men, young adults, husbands, fathers, to live more deeply in their faith. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thank you very much, both of you, for having me. It's great to be with you.
So, Sean, you serve as the Senior Director of Evangelization and Education for the Knights of Columbus, and you've been with the Knights since 2018. Can you tell us a little bit about your time as a focus missionary for 10 years before that and how that leads into this new initiative?
Absolutely. God's timing is hilarious, and sometimes in every moment you're trying to figure out, Lord, what are you doing? What are you doing? Where is this going? And only lets you know right before something's going to change. I did not anticipate being with Focus for 10 years. But during that time, as a campus missionary at Benedictine College and then at University of Vermont, two very different campuses, and then serving for 4 years on the formation team as the coordinator for the new staff training for missionaries, which is a 5-week period of formation and training to prepare them for campus. Through all of those, God really prepared me to, I would say, for what I'm doing right now. You prepared me in my vocation, but with my wife Emily and our four boys, but also for building, I think, CORE for the Knights of Columbus. And what does it mean to for me to grow in it with a zeal for souls, a desire for evangelizing men, and helping them grow as missionary disciples? So, Focus, I credit the many men and women who invested in me during that time, and of course the grace of God to prepare me and to form my heart in this way, to have that love of souls. And for me, learning about Father McGivney was a great connection to all of this, because for him, in his pastoral heart, 143 years ago, founding the Knights of Columbus based upon the needs he saw, and his desire to keep men faithful in a time when the culture was pulling them away from the church, pulling them out, away from their family, out of the faith, and saying, no, as your pastor here to care for your soul, I'm going to do whatever I can to keep you faithful and in the church and within a fraternity that will help you stay faithful, but also help you protect your family. And again, the Lord and his mysterious working, and how he brought, for me, these two worlds together. And especially now with creating CORE, to very intentionally create the space for prayer, formation, and fraternity, for men to build that Christ-centered brotherhood, to grow in faith together, and to sharpen each other as iron sharpens iron in living their vocation fully, to become the man that God created them to be.
Supreme Knight Patrick Kelly has called CORE the future for the Knights of Columbus. And I see that it's a program that's not just for knights, but it's open to all men. Can you tell us kind of some of the nuts and bolts of what the program entails?
Absolutely. So, as you said, CORE is open to every man of the parish. And so if a council is running CORE, parish is offering CORE, we said, yes, invite everyone, because we want to provide this opportunity for men. And we, as we've structured it, it's a flexible structure of prayer, formation, and fraternity. So that's meant to be directed by the needs of the men. So it's not driven by a curriculum or content. There are many men's groups that have fantastic content out there, fantastic prayer or formative content. But we've seen that a lot of the time that content is what drives it. And once that content's done, a lot of times the guys say, okay, what's next? What are we doing next? And for CORE, we said, how about you guys focus on the brotherhood you're building? And how does the content, whether it's coming from us or other Catholic groups, how is that content supplementing what you need? So we said, hold CORE as frequently and as, you know, well, no less than once a month, but maybe as frequently as twice a month or weekly. And we've actually seen the greatest success with twice a month or weekly, and hold it from 60 to 90 minutes each time, and find a time that's best for the guys, but have an intentional time of prayer, not just starting and closing with prayer, but for guys getting started, we said, start with the rosary, help guys grow in the devotion of the rosary, and pray that together. You know, see if there's any intentions or, you know, intercessory prayer that needs to come from the group, pray the rosary. For formation, start with Into the Breach, get to know each other. And the Into the Breach video series that we have presents content and topics for guys to dive into, but in a way that's also, we feel like it's kind of like an easy on-ramp so that you're not just thrown in the middle of a deep conversation that's demanding a lot of you. And oh, I don't really know these guys. I don't necessarily trust these guys. How are we going to do this? So we said, start there. It's a great, I don't want to say shallow one. They're good topics, but it helps build that conversation naturally. And then for the fraternity component, for that to be that conversation and maybe a shared meal. If you hold core in the morning, like I have, coffee and donuts, it's always a crowd pleaser. But getting to know each other, having those conversations, and then allowing that fraternal time not just to be a shared time, that's hanging out, but building the freedom for that to go deep and actually share life. So that's how the encouragement has been looking like. So any council could look different in terms of what core looks like, but that structure of prayer, formation, and fraternity will be present every time.
Sean, I grew up in an era where my dad was a member of a lot of fraternal organizations. Back in the day, there was the Kiwanis, there was Rotary, there was Elks, and then Knights of Columbus was kind of the Catholic fraternal organization. And then, I guess there were Shriners, and then we saw a lot of that wane. And so it seems to me like you're kind of trying to reinvent a fraternal organization for the 20th century. And tell us, were your numbers shrinking as the Knights aged? And is this kind of a reboot? And do you see this as a multi-generational fraternal organization, or are you kind of more trying to captivate younger men who feel kind of beaten down by the culture?
So we've seen as the Knights of Columbus as one of the few now fraternal benefit societies in the country. We just actually had our largest growth year ever this past year.
Wow.
Thanks be to God. Praise God. We just had the largest growth year, and the last time that we saw growth like this were actually after periods of war. So the First World War, Second World War.
Right.
Vietnam, where guys are coming back and like, we need brotherhood, we need community. And I think we're seeing it. We're in a time right now where so many Catholic men, there's that quote, men are leading lives of quiet desperation, where they're striving for brotherhood. Like, I need this. I need time with men to just talk about life. I have my faith here, my life here. How do I bring these together, guys? What does this practically look like? Help me be a better husband. Help me be a better father. So we are trying to appeal through core to all generations, and really to provide a means of true mentorship within this fraternity. I think we've seen in the church, we've seen young adults invested in, we've seen youth ministries invested in. But then, okay, once you're out of the young adult group, what do you have there? And
That's so
we want,
true.
right? And so we're like,
Yeah.
well, we want this. Any man who's 18 years and up can be a Knight of Columbus. How do we connect them to each other? What can I learn from, the 60, 70, 80-year-old guys and how they live their vocation, how they raise their children? But also, how can I provide a mentorship to them, based upon what the Lord has gifted me with, and build true friendships? And I think that's we're seeing and hearing from many councils, many men that. We're providing something that they've been looking for a long time.
Just kind of following up on Betsy's question, the Knights of Columbus really is unique in the way that it's endured and thrived as so many other fraternal organizations, just general organizations. I mean, you look at like the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts, they're just all kind of imploding. And I find that so interesting, a comment about the war, because if you think about the sexual revolution, like we call it a revolution. I mean, it was a kind of a war in a different way, a war on the human person, but to what do you attribute the enduring nature of the Knights of Columbus as compared with, maybe not comparing to other organizations, but to, what has made the Knights of Columbus such an incredible enduring success?
Actually, that's a great question. I think we can't forget the vision of Father McGivney and blessed Father McGivney and his intercession for the Knights of Columbus. How many other fraternal organizations can say their founder is a blessed? And his intercession is powerful, but his mission and the brilliance of making it not about him. He founded the Knights of Columbus, but didn't make himself the first Supreme Knight. He turned to the men that he founded it with and said, "You guys will be the leadership. I'll be the supreme chaplain. I will be the chaplaincy here, and because I want to shepherd your souls and help you guys discern what this needs to look like." And I think the structure that they built, in the council structure, the leadership structure, was brilliant because it because men need structure. Left to our own devices, it could go all over. And I think there was a brilliance, by the grace of God, to structure the Knights of Columbus the way he did, but with the vision for the man and the family. And that those needs, whether 143 years ago or 143 years from now, will be the same. Men will still are still going to be called to be holy husbands and fathers. They will still be called to protect their family, spiritually and physically, financially. And right now, for us, again, Betsy, getting to you, the other part of your question, are we reinventing ourselves? CORE is new, but we're not reinventing ourselves. If anything, we're honing in more deeply on the original vision of Father McGivney, and how are we bringing back that vision to the forefront of who we are, and that expression of who we are as Knights of Columbus.
Again, going back to my dad, there was a lot of emphasis on service when I was growing up in the Knights of Columbus. They had the turkey dinners and they served the poor, the needy. But you have a program that I don't recall, and maybe it was in Knights of Columbus, that is a Bible study, the Sword of the Spirit. Is that correct? Is that the name of your
Men of the
program?
our the Bible study we just created, Men of the Word. It's close.
Okay. You're inviting, I'm looking at my notes, you're
Yeah.
inviting participants to take up the Sword of the Spirit.
Yes.
And so can you tell us, is this a new venture within Knights of Columbus to have offer Bible study?
So we have the for 75 years now, we've had the Catholic Information Services portion of the Knights of Columbus. And so if you I think a lot of people would recognize the kiosk of booklets in the back of the church that have
Sure.
all the different titles and the Knights of Columbus on it. That Catholic Information Service, or CIS, has been around for 75 years. And so creating these booklets, which is it is such rich content, catechetical content, formative content. It's been used in prison ministry for years. And we just give it away. We give this away to make this available. And the Bible study comes from CIS, and everything that CIS is working to do now is to fill and fit into CORE. So the Bible study was built with CORE in mind. How does it help with the prayer formation and fraternity that we experience in CORE? The CORE Ecclesia series that we're working on, the new CORE of McGivney, which are looking at his life and what can we draw from his example of his life and virtue, for men. So all of these are being built now in the context of CORE. But again, we have 75 years worth of resources that can also be utilized as well.
You mentioned friendship, structure as things that men are really yearning for. And there's no question, I think everybody on every side of the political aisle would agree that there's kind of a crisis of masculinity. There's endless books. What are some of the other kind of issues or battles, struggles, hopes that you see men coming into this program with at the forefront of their minds and their hearts?
I think in my experience thus far, guys are looking for practical help on how do I live my faith? Yes, I go to mass every Sunday, maybe daily. I hear a homily. I might have an idea of devotions I need to dive into, or I have an aspiration for what my prayer life and sacramental life should look like. But practically, I really don't know where to start or how to do that. Or I don't, I believe my faith, but I don't really know how to talk about it. I don't know how to share it. And it gets me, yeah, I get really nervous because I don't want to misspeak, and I don't want to lead someone astray, or that's just, I put it in a silo over there and it stays there. So we're seeing a lot of guys who want to practically understand, but practically apply and live their faith. But they're, and within that, I would say even more pointedly, guys want help in their marriage. Hey, brothers, how are you doing this? How are you serving your wife? How are you growing in holiness? How are you leading your family in prayer? What does that look like? How do you pray with your wife? How do you pray with your kids? Grandfathers, how are you praying with your grandkids? What does that look like? Young men, how are you discerning your vocation? or older guys, how did you discern your vocation? Can you help me out here? So I think a lot of it comes to the practical lived experience of vocation. How do I live this? And guys, help me out. So I think that again, we'll see that need continuing. I think we need that within the community of that brotherhood. We need that support, that iron sharpening iron, but also the evangelization that comes from that. We get to help each other grow closer to God. We get to encounter God, to encounter Jesus Christ, and for that to inflame our hearts and to enliven us and animate everything that we do. So when you talk about all the charitable work that the Knights of Columbus still do, how is CORE and everything that we're doing and growing in our faith animating everything that the councils still do?
So I watched your video, Sean. It was kind of an intro video online, and one of the things that jumped out at me is that local parishes can use this to actually grow their congregation. That people might be drawn because of this particular organ, the Knights of Columbus offering something for men in particular. How are you implementing this? Are you trying to start new chapters? Or are you just leaning on your existing network of Knights chapters? Tell us a little bit about how you're trying to get this into the parishes.
So we are using initially our again the parish structure, so the council structure within parishes. So we have over 16,000 councils across the world, 12,000 between the U.S. and Canada. So
Amazing.
the Knights of Columbus are in the United States, all the provinces of Canada, Mexico, Poland, Ukraine, France, Guam, Dominican Republic, technically Cuba. I know I'm forgetting somewhere, South Korea, and the Philippines. And we are, that fraternal dynamic. There are a lot of cultures across the Knights of Columbus. And one thing that we've seen is that we have the council structure, and so that's helped get CORE moving. And we've created leadership positions within the state councils that, there's a state council that runs the Knights of Columbus for that particular state or jurisdiction and the local council. So we've utilized the structure we have because of the brilliance in what Father McGivney set up in that structure. But also, and particularly looking at cultures where relationship and trust are very, very important. And that human encounter over necessarily structure. And maybe it's harder to start with structure, but it's easier to start with relationship, particularly Hispanic parishes in the US, where we're seeing CORE is the entryway to introduce the Knights of Columbus holistically. And to those pastors who might be immigrant pastors who don't necessarily know or haven't had a cultural experience at the Knights of Columbus, but CORE is because there's a great freedom in its structure for it to be enculturated to whichever group of men are running CORE, offering CORE, but also in how that connects to the parish, how that connects to the pastoral mission of the pastor. And CORE is only being done in a parish where the pastor has given his permission, and not competing with another men's ministry. So, Father, we want your permission because we're stepping into your territory, which is formation of souls. Not only do we want permission, but we want your invitation to men, your endorsement, and your help in this. And that's where bridging that gap for existing parishes and existing councils, but parishes that don't have the knights. And we could, again, hopefully the CORE is an avenue to bringing a council there to offer, again, the whole experience of what the Knights of Columbus offers for men.
So where can our listeners learn more about your program?
So if you go to kfc.org/CORE, everything is there. The why, the purpose behind CORE, all the way up to how to get CORE started in your parish, written material and video training videos to get all of this moving and get it started. And if you have a Knights of Columbus council and you don't have CORE, I encourage you to talk to the council leadership, talk to the knights there, and talk to your pastor to see, how can we get CORE started, and also pray if God's asking you to lead it. And for those who are, again, who might not have a council, please look at those resources. Again, that we believe that this structure exists to serve parish communities everywhere. So utilize those resources again at kfc.org/CORE.
Well, we're really excited for you and for this new program, and we thank you for coming on the show. And everyone, check out all of Sean's resources, and to learn more about the Catholic Association and to follow everything we do, Substack, Twitter, TV, radio, print, please go to our website, catholicassociation.org. Thanks so much for joining us, Sean.
Betsy, Ashley, thank you so much for having me. It's a joy to be with you.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire, and we're talking with our wonderful TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry, and we're commemorating a wonderful American holiday, the 4th of July, the American Independence. And, you know, that means so much more than barbecues and swimming pools and all of that. It's really a wonderful opportunity to reflect on the extraordinarily unique freedoms that we enjoy in this country that have been hard fought over hundreds of years, and especially our first freedom, which is what our founders called it, which was religious freedom. Monsignor, tell us about especially the Catholic contribution to this freedom. I think that's often overlooked in when we think about religious freedom, but the role of the church in America in promoting and safeguarding this essential freedom of ours.
Well, first, happy 249th birthday, Ashley.
Yes.
I'm super excited as we start the gear up for our 250th birthday as a country. It's a time to go back to think about how many people fought for freedom. First, freedom from what we clearly labeled as the tyranny of George III. But there was always a freedom for. We have a real idea of what it means to be American. And our founding fathers were fighting for that idea. They really wanted us to be capable of being free. And they set together this project in ordered liberty to see if we could keep our freedom ordered. Ordered where? Ordered ultimately to the good and to the truth. And so right from the beginning, there was a little bit of a Catholic contribution. We did have Catholic citizens there too, no question about it. But pretty much everybody was in alignment of what we needed freedom from and what we wanted to be able to use that liberation for. Catholics have been able to give much more profound premises to those initial desires. What is our freedom from and what is our freedom for? Freedom from sin, freedom from egotism, freedom from selfishness, freedom in some ways, even from being defined by the past, but then freedom for. How are we going to exercise the gift that God has given us, made in his image and likeness, he who is free, to use that freedom to love? And so we've seen throughout the history, it's not uncheckered, but that Americans, with Catholics being salt, light, and leaven, have sought to use their freedom, our freedom, in order to be able to do good, in order to build real cultures where our families are able to thrive, where each of us is able to try at least to maximize the potentials that God's given us. We've been blessed with such an extraordinary country in terms of its natural endowments. But the greatest gift that we have are the citizens of the country, people who have been united by a certain idea, building on human nature, for us to use that God-given creativity for the good. I've spent a lot of time out of the United States. And what's kind of blown me away is when Europeans look at the U.S., what they see first and foremost as the greatest gift we have that many of them don't is the freedom of association. That we are able to come together and fix problems. Those problems might be small in a neighborhood. Those problems might be huge and national. But we have rights to use our freedom to be able to come together to fix it. We don't have to wait for government bureaucracies to be able to do it. I've learned a lot from the way Europeans have looked at the U.S. And so what is our freedom for and how are we going to use it? Last thing I just want to say, I'm sorry I'm a little long-winded, is back in 2008, when Pope Benedict XVI came to the White House and was received by President Bush, he spoke there about how freedom has got to be won for every generation. We just can't think that this freedom from slavery and freedom for the good, the beautiful, the true, freedom for love can be, we can't take that for granted. It's got to be won by every generation because we're tempted to become addicts to our particular ideas or what our emotions themselves crave. And so Pope Benedict was challenging us to take freedom just as seriously as our founding fathers and to make sure we're passing on a context in which we're genuinely free. That's the challenge that he laid in 2008. And that's the big challenge in 2025 as we prepare for our 250th birthday next year.
Well, certainly freedom of association has allowed the Catholic Church to thrive here in America in a way that maybe it hasn't in other places, especially starting with just physical security, something, a comfort that we enjoy here that many Catholics in the rest of the world don't. But this is an especially exciting fourth for American Catholics because we have an American Pope, something that would have been unthinkable so many years ago. What do you think about American Catholic sentiment right now?
So, American Catholic sentiment has probably never been higher. The fact that we've got somebody who was baptized with American water, who was raised on the sacraments. I mean, all the hosts that were consecrated that he received as a child were made by sisters in the United States. I mean, we can look at his entire upbringing. We're partially responsible for giving the church our first Pope born in the United States. He understands our mentality. He's brought many of the American gifts to the papacy. And so this is a time in which not only are we hearing a successor of St. Peter speak in an unaccented English, but at the same time, he's speaking with an American mentality, speaking as directly as we're accustomed to. And he's bringing typical industry, typical American know-how, can-do attitudes to the papacy. And so I think that that's going to be a revolution at the end of which we're going to see at least the fingerprints of the mystical body being more American.
Well, we thank you, Monsignor, for joining us today. Wish you and all of our listeners a very happy 4th of July. Don't forget to go to Mass. It's one of my favorite times to go to Mass because they sing the beautiful patriotic hymns. And thank you so much, Monsignor, for joining us.
And more than anything, as we do at Mass, we pray for our country, is we and our fellow citizens likewise need those prayers. So happy 4th of July, Ash.
Happy 4th of July.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And it's always fun to catch up on the news of the day. And I definitely want to tell you ladies all about my recent trip to La Crosse, Wisconsin to celebrate Cardinal Raymond Burke's 50 years of priesthood. But first, this is kind of a viral clip that's going around here, but did you ladies hear about the recent clip that Michelle Obama made on her podcast about women and health, particularly reproductive health?
Yes,
Are you ladies
I thought it was
aware of
highly.
that? Yeah, so she, obviously the First Lady, she doesn't really need an introduction. So she made some waves on social media when she talked about women and literally said that the amazing reality of reproduction was what she said is the least fascinating, and I'm putting square quotes around that, about, thing about us. She has a podcast now with her brother, and she shared this on Instagram. And I'm quoting her verbatim. When a woman's body is reduced to the politics of the debate on choice, we neglect to see reproductive health as part of a bigger, broader picture of our overall health. So the former First Lady throws in politicians and male politicians and religious leaders and how women's health is reduced to what she calls the fetus, but then she goes on to say the baby. But then she asserts that reproductive health is about a woman's life, but not about the child that she's carrying. So, you know, there's a lot to unpack there, a lot of it kind of concerning and wrong. What were your reactions when you heard it?
I just thought it was
Man.
so unfortunate. And, you know, it just shows where the Democratic platform mindset is, which is a completely opposite view of, I think, the way that the us and probably most of our listeners look upon the dignity of women.
Yeah. It really is tragic. I mean, I think if anything, it just made me sad because A, what a kind of lack of imagination. I mean, I think her exact quote, "The ability to create life is the least significant function of a woman's reproductive system." I mean, A, that's just plain false. Like
That's why it
Thomas Aquinas
exists.
would have a field day with
Yes,
her.
exactly.
I
That's
want to
why it's
put
there.
Michelle Obama and Thomas Aquinas in a phone booth and see who wins. That would be the quickest knife fight ever. No, but like you think about teleology. In fact, teleology, which it's basically the philosophy of purpose, like what are the
Right.
hierarchy of purposes of a thing? And it's like You can start simple, like a chair. What is the purpose of a chair? But when you get to the human body, I mean, things get really fascinating. And it was actually kind of the Catholic teleology of the human body that brought me into the church because I found it so fascinating. Opposite of Michelle Obama, I found it to be the most fascinating thing. I had never really thought about the fact that, yes, you can't deny that the ability to create life is the most sacred and fascinating thing about our quote unquote reproductive system, which can we retire that phrase? I'm so sick of it. It's,
Yeah.
but
Well, I think
it's
the
so
other thing,
mechanical.
it's also why being a consecrated virgin or a celibate priest is a real sacrifice. I mean, that's what I love about the church is that there are many different paths to holiness, vocational paths. And it's because the capacity to give birth or to be a father is really at the core of being a man or a woman. And that's why it's such a big deal to give it up.
Well, there's just the kind of this undergirding too, that there's like a like the baby's some kind of invader, that wasn't created by consent and has now, taken, like a squatter, like has squatter rights in your body or something. It's this way of thinking about the child is not as an extension of you and someone that God has given you to nurture and protect and take care of. And instead, it's like an imposition that's placed on you.
But it is important, I think, to talk about this quote of hers because it's so indicative of where we are culturally. And it's kind of fascinating. It's like we're in this epic moment of collective cultural navel gazing where we're like, oh my gosh, the birth dearth crisis, alert, alert. And then everybody, then we turn around and all talk about Michelle Obama saying this. And but it's like, no, this is actually, I think, mentally where a lot of people in our society are, and we're starting to see that it has very acute potential impacts coming down the pike.
Yeah. And too, I just feel like when you have someone like Michelle Obama, who's so incredibly well educated, Princeton undergrad and Harvard Law School, has met every dignitary in the world, has three beautiful homes now and two beautiful daughters. And I feel like she could be doing so much more to uplift women, particularly American women who are really struggling in many different ways in some rural parts of the country, and to encourage them, that sort of stuff. And it just seems to me such a missed opportunity. I wrote about this at the time when Hillary Clinton lost the election to Donald Trump, and then soon thereafter gave the commencement address at Wellesley, where she went to undergrad. And again, what a great moment to say, you know what, ladies, you're heading out in your life, you're going to work really hard, and sometimes things aren't going to work out the way you wanted. And they didn't for me, but that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with me or there's anything wrong with you. And you got to pick up the pieces and go on. And if that's the one lesson you can learn, you cannot let life, which is going to happen to everybody, deter you from the good that you can do every day in your own life. But instead, it was kind of like the Michelle Obama sort of rant. And I just thought, what a missed opportunity for so many young women whom she could have influenced with that talk.
Right, she's had so many privileges. And I think if that's a good segue into why we see a lot of really talented, privileged people not be on board with creating a culture of life and big families. And so we have a daily clip that goes out Monday through Friday to subscribers. It's free and it's called Media Monitoring. And please go to our website and sign up if you'd like to get that in your inbox. And today we have two pieces on the birth rate. And maybe we could talk a little bit about them. The first is the birth rate crisis isn't as bad as you've heard. It's worse, set to start shrinking several decades ahead of schedule. And then a letter that was a response to Matthew Hennessy's piece called You Can't Legislate Fertility, called What the Right Gets Wrong About Birth Rates. What do you all think about that whole subject?
Well, I read all those pieces, and I love Matthew Hennessy, but I think I disagree with his take, which is, as you put it, you can't legislate family policies. And Ryan Anderson made a similar point in his First Things piece, where he said people aren't going to have another baby because you give them $3,000. And that's correct. Like, that is not the end-all solution to creating a pro-family, pro-life culture that wants to have more than 1.65 children or whatever. But definitely in the camp that believes that law influences culture, And I absolutely believe that we should be structuring our tax code and designing laws and policies in such a way that send a clear signal that this is a cultural priority, this is a societal priority, and that the law is here to protect and nurture and help families. And I mean, man, you know, some of these policies in Hungary, gosh, I wouldn't have to pay income tax if I lived in Hungary.
Right.
But
Is it working, Ashley, in Hungary?
my understanding is that their birth rate, and I think Matthew Hennessy alludes to this in his piece, that there have been some upticks in some of these places, but they're not enough. And that's where I think Catherine Bacolik's response is somewhat correct, which is that this is, you know, to get back to Michelle Obama, this is like a failure of imagination. This is a mindset where people do not value children. And I mean, on the one hand, who can blame women? Because the only message young women have been getting, like since I was in college, is that marriage and family hold you back, slow you down. They're a hindrance, they're a burden, yada yada. And she's right about that. But on the other hand, you can't just brush off the financial component. Like the barriers to having children and a family in this culture, financial costs are very acute. I mean, I know people who had to delay having children because they had such high student loan debt that they couldn't not work because they had to pay their student loans, and they couldn't afford a daycare or childcare payment on top of that because they had to keep working. And that's a real pickle. And this is where people are. They're coming out of college with six figures of debt.
Right.
And you have to have two, you know, incomes in most places. And there's no family support. People are broken away from the traditional, you know, multi-generational structure of family. I mean, Betsy, your children are so lucky to have you as able to help support your children. That's the exception to the norm.
I just think people don't all live, so many of my friends, and even in my own family, people disperse. They go away to college and then they go where they get their good job, and they're not thinking down the line about not only childcare, but being able to help aging parents as well.
Right. Yeah. And then when you are in what they call the sandwich generation, which means you have younger kids still in school and your parents are aging. And I went through this myself. I've lost both my parents, but it was at the time, you know, three of my kids were still in grade school. And yeah, that's a lot of stress on an adult child of an elderly person, plus the mother of kids to whom you owe your first duty, right? They have to be your first priority. So yeah, the way we're dispersed across the country in such a big country, and it can be very difficult to get to family.
I saw an article just a couple of days ago that said that I think in the 1950s and 60s, you could, in what you made as like an intern, a summer intern, you could pay a full year of in-state tuition. You know, just the cost of things was different. Like the way society was structured is that, you know, a middle class working man could buy a home, a modest home and a car, and, you know, their kids could go to the public schools. I mean, that's another thing. It's like
Right.
you for many of us, sending your kids to public school is not an option because of what we just saw with the Supreme Court.
Right.
This is the kind of battles that parents are fighting, is whether or not their 4-year-old is going to be forcibly taught sexually explicit lessons in public school. So it's like, you know, if you're a family that's values your faith and your moral beliefs, I mean, just the cost of private school, parochial school is
Right.
a challenge. So it's just a completely different financial landscape and family structure landscape. And you know, I think the reason people are leaving their families is not because they want to, but because they're searching for better paying jobs so that they
Right.
can, you know, it's this vicious cycle to be able to pay for their kids to go to Catholic school or what have you. I mean, certainly there's a component of, does everybody in the family need iPhones, and do we have to have two luxury cars? I mean, it's not entirely that. It's just that the basic costs for families raising children are just completely different than what they used to be. And if you don't have a grandma around the corner who can help babysit your kids, and
Right.
you have to work because you need the income to pay the mortgage, it's really challenging. And that's, I think, something that we have to acknowledge as a starting point if we're trying to shape the culture to be more pro-family. We can't just brush that off. And that's to close the loop on the Matthew Hennessy piece. That's where I think, you know, yes, $3,000 more tax credit, is that going to create a baby boom? Not necessarily, but it's a step. it's a starting point of saying we, as you know, your policymakers are acknowledging the challenges and trying to, you know, begin to make an impact.
Well,
Yeah.
I agree with what you say, but and it's hard to not judge people about this, but when I look at my own parish, it's a very stable parish, and I look at the number of people that I know that came from families of seven, eight, or nine kids. And, you know, there were four kids in bunk beds in one bedroom, and the boys were in one and girls in another. And I'm not saying that you know, that's the way everybody has to live, but I do marriage prep in our parish. And one of the things that we talk about is the golden handcuffs, which is having a mortgage tied to two incomes. And that there are steps that you have to take even before you get married, or you will end up kind of unknowingly in the situation. And then also for the parochial schools, you know, the nuns basically gave free labor. I mean, that's a huge component of what the Catholic school situation is now, is that as the orders shrunk and as lay people said, this isn't really a living wage for me, you know, they needed a better income. The whole landscape of tuition and pay in Catholic schools also changed dramatically. Do
Yeah.
you all
I know.
remember at the Catholic Women's Forum, Helen Alvare made the point that you just made, Betsy, about, you know, an important piece of empowering women is like as you're preparing for marriage, making sure that you structure your life such that you can live on one income and like to be
Right.
thrifty and that actually frees women up. Like I think feminists tear their hair out because they're like, oh, you're taking us back to the 1950s. But no, it just gives women choices, which,
Right.
you know,
And I
we
did say
know.
that before we
Yeah.
got married. I said, I want to be home with our kids and I won't do science fair or driving lessons.
Science fair.
That was wise to get that out of the way up front. That was
You know
very
what? I did it.
strategic thinking, Betsy.
So, Mary, I heard that you were in La Crosse, Wisconsin over the weekend for quite a big celebration. Can you tell us about Cardinal Burke's 50th Jubilee?
Well, thank you for asking about that. It was a wonderful weekend in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is just a beautiful part of the Midwest. And Cardinal Raymond Burke, who's the former Archbishop of St. Louis, celebrated his golden anniversary, so the 50-year anniversary of his ordination to the priesthood. And he has been very instrumental in building, well, I mean, actually, he's been doing it. He's the key person building the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe in La Crosse. And if you're ever in the Midwest, particularly in the fall, the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe should be on your Catholic bucket list because it is spectacularly beautiful. And it was designed by Duncan Struyck, who's an architect from the University of Notre Dame, who's known for doing church art. So it's both traditional and modern at the same time. It's kind of hard to describe. And it is just an incredible place for prayer, for regular confessions. There's an outdoor Stations of the Cross. And very movingly, there is a garden with the remains of either miscarried, stillborn, or aborted babies who are laid to rest and given a name. In this garden that has a lovely statue of Our Lady weeping over, you know, a lost child. And so a lot of people, when they lose a child to miscarriage in particular, go to are welcomed to the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe to have a little burial service for their child, which really does help bring about closure for many families. But through the generosity of a donor, there was a lovely black tie dinner after Cardinal Burke did a personal tour of the basilica, or not the basilica, but the shrine there for everyone, and really interesting people from the Catholic world in attendance, including Gianna Emanuela Mola, who is the daughter of Saint Gianna Beretta Mola, and she was there and was wearing a suit that had belonged to her mother. Her mother was quite. I've always had an affinity with her because she loved clothes, and in fact, one of the last things her husband Pietro did for her was to bring her back a copy of French Vogue when he went to Paris on a business trip. And she was quite sick at the time. And she said, if I make it through this, I'm going to get myself some nice clothes to treat myself. So she had spectacularly beautiful, Milan Italian clothes. But it was such a delight to speak to her daughter. I've met her before, but we had a nice little catch up. And, she was telling me she's going to be in the States more and more because they are working on the canonization cause for her father. So Saint Gianna Beretta Mola's husband, Pietro, who lived to 94, so quite a while after he was widowed, and just was an exemplary husband and father. And so they may be very soon joining Saint Therese's parents, Louis and Zélie Martin, as a married couple who were saints.
Do they have other living children?
They do, yes. So yeah, Gianna Emanuela was their youngest. I believe there were five children in the family. And her older brother is also a physician. Gianna Emanuela was a geriatric doctor, stopped practicing medicine to take care of her elderly father, and now just works on their causes and promoting their causes. But there were four older children.
Were there any other prelates of note at the gala?
Yeah, there weren't any other cardinals, and unfortunately for Cardinal Burke, the ordinations in La Crosse were taking place the same day. So there were 2 days of celebration, one with the board of directors of the shrine, which I happen to serve on, and some significant donors to the shrine who have helped to make that dream possible. And then the next day, there was a public mass and then a public reception for anybody who wanted to come. And I think because of the ordinations being on Saturday, a lot of the bishops were opting to come to the Sunday events because they really had to be there for the ordinations of the new priests, which is entirely appropriate. But I can't imagine if they had tried to combine the 2 days. It was packed to the gills. It was a lovely show of support for the cardinal. And the shrine right now is undertaking the construction of a retreat house. So there's this beautiful church, and now there'll be a beautiful retreat house next door to it where priests and religious and lay people can come and, have a retreat experience. And, it used to be interesting in the early days of the pro-life movement when I first joined, every year there was a special retreat for people who worked in the pro-life movement. And it was held on the East Coast, and Father Benedict Rochelle would lead it, and their other priests would come because there's such a particular, type of sacrifice you're making when you're working very publicly in the pro-life movement. Certainly in the 80s and early 90s, there was always this special retreat, and then after the retreat master who always coordinated this passed away, nobody ever took it up again. And Our Lady of Guadalupe is patroness of the unborn. So I'm hoping when this retreat house is completed that we can reinstitute that retreat for pro-life leadership.
Did he say much about the Pope, whether he's had any chance to meet with him?
Well, it was funny because I had, there was a receiving line and we each got to, say a few words to the cardinal. And it was so hot. It had to be like 92 or 93 degrees. And, and the poor man was in his vestments. I don't know how I felt like I was going to, pass out if I didn't get some cold water. I don't know how he sat there greeting all these people, but I leaned over to him and I said, "Ho," I said, "Your Eminence," I said, "did you hear that the new Holy Father's from Chicago?" And he just looked at me and burst out laughing. And he was like, "Mary, stop it." So, but we had a nice, there are some cardinals that have been a little bit more open about talking about what the conclave was like inside. He has not. He's been very quiet, asking for prayers for the new Holy Father that, his ministry among us will be blessed. And he composed a prayer. So he's been approaching it in a very sort of fraternal, collegial way. But you could see, when I said that to him, he seems very happy and pleased with the choice of the new Holy Father. That was very clear to me.
You mentioned being with Gianna Mola's daughter, and I've often thought how amazing it would be to be alive to see a family member canonized, kind of like the mother of Carlo Acutis. And
And Maria Goretti's parents.
I noticed in the clips also an article about a new center that has been commissioned by Archbishop Corleone, basically like a school for learning about the canonization process. And I thought I'll read the headline. It was in the Washington Post, actually. It's first U.S. center to train Catholics on canonization process to open in 2026. I might need to go to that because I've got some people that I want to see canonized. My a personal cause that we have in our family is the priest Lamy, who founded Santa Fe. And it's just a very special place to us. And I think there's absolutely a case to be made to put his cause forward. And I think it's maybe just because people don't know a lot about him. He's from a part of the world where there's just the diocese is not that big. But anyways, so stay tuned. If you end up reading that, I go to the canonization school.
Well, you can give out copies of Willa Cather's Death Comes Through the Archbishop because
Yep.
she wrote that
I was
about
just going to
LeMay,
mention that.
which is such a beautiful book written by somebody who's not a Catholic. But I had the privilege of being in Santa Fe about 8 months ago and went to some of the different places, his first mass, et cetera, et cetera. There's a great local devotion to him. He's everywhere. There's statues, there's his first church. If one of the indicators is a personal, what the church would say, cult, which is not in the secular sense of the word, but a personal admiration for him that arises out of the lay faithful locally, then that's often a sign of the person's sanctity.
That's so interesting because my husband and I went onto the construction site. His private chapel and home has now been turned into like a 5-star lodge or whatever, but they kept the home and it was under construction. I took a little piece of debris when we were there because I thought, this could be a relic one day.
For sure. Yeah, that was wise thinking. Cardinal George told me a story one time. He was the member of a religious order from France called the Missionary Oblates of Mary Immaculate. And they were assigned to evangelize in Alaska. And so they sent these French missionaries over there to try to evangelize among the populations there. And they had like zero luck. Like they didn't have one conversion, nothing. They were just like, they just hit a brick wall. So they came home to France during the summer to go back to the order for community meetings. And they went to the grave of Saint Therese and they dug up some of the dirt from her grave, went back to Alaska after, and just conversions by the thousands and thousands. And they attribute that to that piece of, dirt from her grave that they brought back. And that, she was the patron saint of missionaries. They said, we're utter failures here and we need your help. And she came through in a big way. So that was a very smart move to do you have it like in a special place at your house, Ashley? I did that one time with something else and my husband didn't know what it was and he threw it out.
Oh, no.
I'm not going to say whose grave. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, well, it was dirt. I threw it out. So my attempt at doing that failed. And I won't mention the person's grave that I was visiting because it wouldn't be appropriate. But I'm glad your husband didn't throw it out or your kids. You got to
Yeah.
hide that stuff.
I think we have time for one more quick discussion from our clips. What do you all think about the communion showdown in the UK between it was a parish priest who refused communion to someone in his parish who had voted for the assisted suicide measure in Parliament?
Right, as well as the expansion of abortion bill. He voted for aborting babies. And, this is this kind of Catholic politicians and communion issue. I had to deal with that a lot when I was the vice chancellor at the Archdiocese. And we had a very similar situation with a politician here named Richard Phelan, who's now dead, but he had instated public funded abortions at Cook County Hospital in the Chicago area. And Cardinal Bernardine called him in and warned him privately and said, if you do this, I'm going to have you're going to separate yourself from the church. You are choosing to do this, but you are a public figure and you are giving me no choice not to, to do this to you privately. It's going to have to be public. And I happened to be in one of the meetings with him and he got tears in his eyes. He said, I'm not going to be able to go to communion. And, the answer was no. What part of no did you not understand? So, this goes back. There are times when you have public figures who commit grave public sins, and it would be a scandal to allow them to access the sacraments. And canon law is very clear about this. Another case was the Spilotro brothers, who are featured in the movie Casino. They were both mob men, murdered very violently and suddenly, and Cardinal Bernardine denied them a funeral mass. He allowed them Christian burial, but they could not have a funeral mass. So there are times where you act publicly and you're a public figure. You are giving the church no choice. It may seem unfair or whatever, and maybe he was representing the views of his constituents, but he still has an obligation as a Catholic.
Hopefully, we'll get some direction from the new Pope on this matter.
I hope so, because he's a canon lawyer, so he'd be very careful.
I saw on Twitter somebody kind of put it succinctly. They said, you don't get to vote for something evil on Saturday and then go to communion on Sundays.
Right, like
It's
nothing happened.
there's some kind of plain textbook stuff.
Right. Well, the best quote I saw was from another Englishman who said, "We had this guy named Saint Thomas More. You might want to look him up." I'm like,
Check
that
it
is
out.
like,
Check out the
That's
show Wolf
yep,
Hall for more
that's the win.
info.
You won the internet today, friend. That's what I said to him. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us for our conversation today. This has been Mary Fiorito, Ashley McGuire, and Betsy Frentress. You can catch all of our TCA team at thecatholicassociation.org.